This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. The city of Chicago has many things that distinguish it, not all good. For example, the first half of this year saw hundreds of shooting incidents and gun deaths. The Chicago Police Department has been rife with a history of police violence and brutality. And Chicago's mayor has been found to be at a center of corruption allegations. Many of these issues can be traced back to the city's history, in particular how urban planning, geography, police surveillance and abuse, as well as incarceration have intersected to create prison-like environments, particularly for the city's black population. My guest is Rashad Shabazz. He is an associate professor in the School of Social Transformation at Arizona State University, and he's just written a book called Spatializing Blackness, Architectures of Confinement and Black Masculinity in Chicago. Welcome to the program, Rashad.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
So first, let's just talk about the city as a whole, just to kind of set the tone for our conversation. Chicago is a city like almost no other in the United States. I mentioned a few of the things, not good things, that necessarily kind of distinguish it from other cities. What is it about this city that led you to examining how geography and mass incarceration and other things intersect to sort of examine these issues in this city?
Well, there's several reasons, Sonali, that I chose Chicago. First and foremost, I was born and raised in Chicago on the South Side during the 1980s and early 90s, so it's my hometown. And I have a relationship with the community, and having grown up there and have seen the city transform over the two decades that I lived there, plus seeing it continue to change, sparked me to write this book. And also, Chicago has a really distinct and unique history. It's the most segregated, if not one of the most segregated cities in North America. It has a very particular racial history. And Chicago is also home to diverse populations of ethnic and racial minorities. It has the largest population of Polish people outside of Poland. It at one time had the largest black population of any northern city. And Chicago also has this unique distinction of violence. Particularly over the last 20 to 30 years, we've been seeing forms of violence, street violence in the city, and the police's relationship with those communities that are under assault have historically been fractured. So in writing this book, I was attempting to answer many questions to try to find out why the city was so segregated, what do these histories of violence mean to it, and what does this mean with respect to high incarceration rates?
Right. And of course, this idea and this phrase machine politics is always sort of linked to Chicago, where the political structures, which were often linked with police corruption, were also, you know, they become the synonym in our political landscape for essentially corruption, with Chicago being the origin of that. You start your book out talking about how the policing of race mixing in Chicago historically has a lot to do with how the city is today. Tell us a little bit about that history, that this idea of black and white relationships with one another was antithetical, which we know, of course, know was around the country, but why specifically Chicago was it an important issue to examine?
Yeah, it's a really fascinating history, and it really speaks to the evolution of Chicago during the Great Migration periods of the late 19th and early 20th century. And it also speaks to the deep anxiety that the nation has had as a whole, and the South and the North has grappled with for centuries now. But in the early part of the 20th century, Chicago had a robust, lively, and fairly famous vice district near the downtown. It was called the Levee. And the Levee had what any vice district would have: gambling, prostitution, music, alcohol. You know, it was one of these places that men and women particularly, you know, middle class whites, as well as some working class whites and people of color, would go to. And another important part of the Levee was that there was also an underground sex scene, right? And this underground sex scene was basically, it was a interracial, largely black and white scene that allowed for blacks and whites who were interested in meeting, dancing, drinking, talking, socializing, and having sex to meet up. And it was in the back of these pool halls and nightclubs and bars. And this was something that the Levee was well known for. But as, so this is the early part of the 20th century, but as black people began to migrate up out of the South, fleeing the terrorism of Jim Crow and being pulled by economic opportunity and the possibility of full citizenship in the North, the community that surrounded the Levee began to change. So that community went from largely German immigrants and Eastern European immigrants, mostly from Poland, to being black almost overnight. You know, between 1916, when the Great Black Migration in Chicago really kicks off, and the middle part of the 1920s, tens of thousands of black people had moved into Chicago. So the Levee, with this well-known avenue for interracial sex and mixture, began to cause a problem in the years after black migration. Now, when it wasn't a black community around the Levee, it was fine. Nobody cared. As a matter of fact, the city celebrated it. But when black people moved in, all of a sudden there was anxiety. And members of the Chicago, mostly white political establishment said that the Levee needed to be cleaned up, right? So the drinking, the gambling, the dancing, all of that needed to be cleaned up. And most importantly, so did these interracial underground nightclubs. They needed to disappear. So what the Chicago political establishment did is they organized their policing network around the elimination of the Levee. And what effectively happened is that they tried to dismantle it, but that didn't work. And instead, what happened was that many of the vices of the Levee, particularly those interracial vices, moved to a new location. There's a theory in policing called the balloon theory. And if you have a balloon and you squeeze it at one end, the air just floats off somewhere else and the balloon gets bigger elsewhere. Well, that's effectively what happened within the context of the Levee. The police were able to choke off the Levee in the downtown, but it spread into the growing black belt by the early 1920s. Right?
And of course, what we sort of see today, are you suggesting then that forces that included the political establishment and the police in trying to continually restrict and also specifically restrict what you refer to in your book as black male sexuality led to these architectures of confinement, as the subtitle to your book suggests, even all the way through to today?
Precisely. So what we began to see is in the early part of the 20th century, the city is being organized around anxieties about the possibility of blacks and whites, particularly black men and white women, having social spaces where they can interact and where they can socialize and potentially have sex, right? And this very much carries over from a lot of the arguments in the aftermath of slavery, that in the South, whites were anxious about what it meant for black people to be free and to control their bodies and their labor. You know, part of it was this belief that they would control their labor and apply for jobs, which they attempted to do. Another part of it was this belief that if black people had a form of physical freedom, a form of social freedom, that they might translate that into a kind of erotic freedom where they would pursue whites, particularly black men pursuing whites. And then all of a sudden you see these discourses about, you know, black sexuality being seen as violent and rapacious. And, you know, black people go from, you know, being seen as sexually immature during the years of slavery to being overtly sexual in the years after slavery.
Right.
So a lot of the entire discourse around Black sexuality that we currently have in this country today really emerges in those years after slavery. But what happened is that as Black people migrated from the South to the North, escaping poverty and Jim Crow racism and lynching, those discourses about their sexuality, those discourses about their potential criminality followed them. So as Black people began to move up to Chicago in the early 20th century, these discourses, these anxieties about what it meant for Black people's bodies, particularly Black men's bodies, to be in public space, and what that meant for the safety of white people, and particularly white women, meant really enabled for the city to organize itself, its entire geography around race.
And
so it created, that context creates the Black Belt.
And so with the migration of Black communities into Chicago, how did the city deal with the need for extra housing? You write in your book about a particular form of housing, the kitchenette, which it might sound like sort of an obscure term, particularly in California where we are today. What is the kitchenette and how did that space evolve? How did Black communities operate within those spaces?
So Black people, as they were only allowed to live within the context of the growing South Side Black Belt because of restrictive covenants, which were contract laws and deeds that were placed into the deed of the home that restricted who could live there. No Chinese, no Mexicans, you can't paint your house pink, so on and so forth. And 85% of Chicago's housing market was governed by these restrictive covenants. So Black people could only live within the Black Belt, that space adjacent to the downtown La Vie on the South Side corridor. So as whites moved out of there and Blacks moved in, there was all this housing that was left over. And many of these houses were old mansions or apartment buildings or duplexes that Blacks lived in. And because so many Black people were moving in at such a rapid rate and the city didn't create housing, Black people were forced to live in these things called kitchenettes, which were basically two-bedroom apartments or three-bedroom apartments that were cut up to service multiple families. So rather than a family living in a two-bedroom apartment where there was, you know, maybe four or potentially five people, different families lived in one room. So in a two-bedroom apartment, you'd have one family living in one bedroom, another family living in another bedroom, and a third family living in the living room. And they called them kitchenettes because they were equipped with a kitchenette unit, which was about a 2 foot high, maybe 16 inch wide hot plate on the top and ice unit below to keep food cold and to cook it on the hot plate. And so Black people lived in these overwhelmingly all throughout the South Side from the early part of Great Black Migration all the way up until nearly until the years right after the Second World War. And that concentration of Black people within that really small space had deep negative implications. Disease was high. The overuse of electrical outlets because of the kitchenettes caused fires. Many Black people and children died as a result of that. Crime was ever present. And it also had implications in terms of how Black men understood, saw, and performed masculinity. Mm-hmm. You know, this notion that to be a man was to be mobile and to have a form of mobility and to have space. And Black men who were sort of tutored under this kind of patriarchal logic, you know, that, you know, masculinity means these things that are often associated with whiteness, that they weren't able to get access to it. And they were living in these small, highly confined, cramped spaces. It produced anger and frustration that was taken out on Black men, on Black women, on Black children. And so it had deep negative implications. Richard Wright wrote beautifully about it in his novel, native son.
And then how do you also trace the rise of the prison complex in Chicago, in and around Chicago, with increasing numbers of black men being imprisoned, and then, you know, their sort of absence within the community, which is a very much a contemporary problem today, not just in Chicago, but around the country?
Yeah, so Chicago is unique because What the history of containment illustrated is that in order for mass incarceration to take place, where you have millions of people, particularly poor and working class people of color, incarcerated, you needed in many respects, they needed to be spatially organized so that the mechanism of policing could arrest them or prevent them from creating crimes. So the spatial organization of Chicago along racial lines in the early 20th century gave rise to mass incarceration in that those communities that were organized and contained and where black people were forced to live also became the epicenters and the places where the police force was modernized, right? So what we began to see is that in the sort of early 20th century, you know, 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, the Chicago Police Department begins to modernize itself and create all these new tactics, and they were deployed within the Black Belt, almost exclusively within the context of the Black Belt. And with that ever presence of policing within the Black Belt, incarceration rates began to rise. And in the years after World War II, and in the years during the industrial rise in the, you know, the 50s and in the decline in the 60s, the concentration of black people within very particular places, right, and the economic challenges that they began to face throughout the 1960s and 70s created instability. But because they were contained in a particular place, and because policing had been an ever-present practice in those communities, they were the ones who became the raw material for the creation of this new economic order and for the rise of mass incarceration, right? Mm-hmm. Because those things had been put in place in the early 20th century with the placement of black people in a particular part of the city, the use of that landscape, that geography, to work out and develop new notions of policing and new tactics of policing, right? And then when you have the economic or post-war economic collapse or the deindustrialization of the economy in the mid-1960s, right, the instability that creates in black communities and communities of color all over the country, but in Chicago in particular, gives rise to policing again, right? And that policing mechanism was already in place because of what had happened in the previous decades.
Now, of course, black communities spoke out, organized, struggled to be heard, and promises were made. In your book, you lay out how promises were made and broken, how there were, at least efforts on the books to do something about things like discriminatory housing. But Chicago remains fairly racially segregated by neighborhood today. Tell us about the failed efforts at desegregation in housing in Chicago.
This is one of my favorite parts of the book because it really illustrates the relationship between state-sanctioned racism and the housing market. So essentially, at the end of World War II, black people are still living in those kitchenettes that I've been speaking about earlier, and they want it out of them. And the United States government comes through with two bills and effectively creates modern forms of public housing, right? And they create project housing and subsidized housing in cities all over the nation, Chicago being one of the big ones that it deployed money into. And it created high-rise housing projects all along the South Side Black Corridor. Now, these housing projects in Chicago and across the nation were only placed in black communities. Why? Because whites fought violently against attempts to bring Black people into their communities.
Of course.
In Chicago, there were riots, there was white violence against Blacks as these project houses were attempted to be moved into those communities. So both the federal and state government gave up and they placed them within the context of Black communities. Now, what this did was it increased the population, right? It further concentrated the population of Black people into very relatively small spaces, right? And in doing that, it once again spatialized Blackness, meaning it placed it in a certain way. But as the post-war economy wore off, you know, that economy that gave rise to the suburbs and, you know, a garage, you know, garages and cars and, you know, the whole sort of post-war, mostly white ideal. As that faded, the concentration of Black people in those housing projects and in those communities created instability. And instead of dealing with the instability through job programs, repairs, you know, all of the things that were going awry in the housing projects, the Chicago Housing Authority, with the backing of the federal government, prisonized them, meaning that it utilized more police, surveillance cameras, turnstiles, plexiglass, courts, on-site courts. So it effectively brought all these mechanisms of containment and punishment into the context of the projects, right? And this was, again, facilitated by the creation of the Black Belt, its containment, the use of policing within that. But then when you place this large edifice, right, this large structure, and the people within that begin to feel instability because of economic woes, you know, they're thrown out of the jobs that they were working in the steel mills on the South Side, right? Those things closed and left for, you know, OSHA-free, regulation-free sites all over the globe, right? And what was supposed to be a temporary form of housing, many people don't know this, but housing projects in the post-war era were created largely as temporary forms of housing that poor people, mostly poor Black people, could live in for a few years and save enough money for the down payment, the 3% that you need for a home. That was largely the point, right? So that's why it was subsidized.
Right.
But when that economic base fell out and instability ensued, the state and the federal government utilized prison mechanisms, right? Containment, policing, surveillance cameras, all of these things to respond.
And of course, that continues to today.
Instability. And that continues to today, right?
Right.
So, and it made it a place where policing practices and where the extraction of people was even more easier because, you know, there was ever-present police in these communities and they didn't create safety. They furthered the instability largely by picking people up, taking them out of the community and disappearing them for a number of years.
So we're discussing geography and how the deployment of these confinements have served to further keep Chicago segregated. What about transportation? Let's talk about public transportation, which of course is very important, particularly to low-income communities within massive urban areas like Chicago. How did the history of transportation impact things like segregation between Black and white neighborhoods?
Transportation from the early part of the 20th century on up until the creation of, I guess you could call it mass transportation during the 1960s when the L train was created, which is the elevated train, moves people around. It had always been organized around race. You know, race played an essential role in it, in that race determined where transportation to and from the city went and when it stopped. You know, there's been numerous transportation studies all over the country that look at the relationship between where people live and where buses go and when they stop and when they don't. And the same thing happened in Chicago. It was very difficult for Black people on the South Side to get to the North Side during certain parts of the day. The North Side has been the historically white part of the city. It was very difficult for Black people to get over there because of the bus system, right? The L train, even in the 60s, the same thing, right? So transportation plays a huge role. And also Chicago is, it's a Midwestern city in that It's very spread out. Chicago, you know, its landmass is quite large. So the South Side is a huge space geographically. The South Side of Chicago is bigger than Manhattan.
Which is why transportation is so important.
Which is why transportation is so important. So the mass transit that we do have, which is basically bus and the L train, are really not sufficient for the population. And like many cities, the car has been made the essential mechanism of transportation, right? So this has, again, foreclosed the possibility of Black people to move around the city in ways that enable them to sort of interact with different people, to experience different parts of the city, to work, you know, a whole range of things, to attend schools, right? So all of those insufficiencies within the context of transportation have made it very difficult for Black people to have mobility in the city.
Well, we only have a couple of minutes left, Rashad. There's so much to discuss in your book, and certainly our audience can get copies of it to get the fullness of it. But finally, let's talk about today, contemporary Chicago, and some of the ways in which Black Chicagoans are attempting to undo the damage caused by these decades of confinement, architectures of confinement, as you describe, and, you know, mass incarceration, as well as neighborhood segregation. What are some of the ways in which people are, you know, sort of taking their own agency back and either desegregating or simply, you know, undermining these imprisonment, various forms of imprisonment?
Well, one of the things that's happening is that Black people are moving into different parts of the city. And some of that is based on their own mobility and some of that is forced. You know, so Black people are now moving into parts of the city that they had once been abandoning because of a lot of reasons. You know, it's somewhat becoming hip and cool. You know, Black folks are, you know, particular classes of Black folks are congregating there. So that's part of it. But the one thing that I write about in the book that I find really productive is that on the South as well as on the West Sides, but particularly on the South Sides, abandoned lots, old abandoned parts of the city are being turned into community-based gardens and or green spaces, right? And this is important for a couple of reasons. That one, we know from large bodies of research that green spaces produce healthier people. There's, you know, they provide shade, they provide spaces for people to play and exercise, spaces for people to walk, to congregate, and to meet, right? And green spaces also provide spaces for food production, right? And this is really important within the context of Chicago because Chicago has one of the worst food deserts in the country, right? You know, along with Detroit and South LA. So having these green spaces allows for poor and working class Black people to get fruits and vegetables in their communities at an affordable rate, right? And it also teaches a skill set to people in the community, how to farm, how to farm tomatoes and peas and corn and several other things, right? So there's a direct health benefit, right? But there's also this geographic benefit in that one of the things that this illustrates is that poor and working class people can be architects of their own future, and they can transform their landscapes for their benefit, right? Landscapes that have been made to contain them, to harm them, to punish them, as was the case for parts of Black Chicago, can be turned into places right. of agricultural production, places to meet, to gather, right? And so I'm really encouraged by the community garden work and the greening of the South and West Sides of Chicago, because it's really a way that these legacies and these histories of containment are being upended and transformed, right? And I think it's a really good first move away from these geographies of containment.
Well, Rashad, I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us, and good luck to you with the book.
Thank you, Sonali. It was a pleasure to be on your show.
Rashad Shabazz is an associate professor in the School of Social Transformation at Arizona State University. His book is entitled Spatializing Blackness, Architectures of Confinement and Black Masculinity in Chicago. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.